From my perspective, management should not exist. And I'm going to say it extremely straight, because leadership should give you the direction, and the people you choose to be beside you, they should be able to follow up on that direction, or to move or to adapt continuously with the company and its vision.
Welcome to the People Stack podcast, where we discuss the intersection of people, work, and technology. I'm your host, Jen Bunk. I am a career coach for tech managers and CEO of the People Stack. My guest for this episode is Adrian Inake. He is a chief executive officer, a board member. He was voted CEO of the year in the UK in 2018. He was listed as a top 100 young manager in Business Magazine, and he is also, among other things, CEO of Angels Den Funding. Welcome, Adrian. It's so awesome to have you on today.
Hi, Jen, and thank you for inviting me.
Yeah, it's my pleasure. I'm really excited to dive in and hear all about your experiences. I know that you have a lot to teach us and share with us, so let's first, understand what it is that you do, so we can get a little bit of context about your experience. So I'd love to hear about Angels Den Funding. What's your mission with that?
So I think Angels Den's funding mission is literally to become one of the largest alternative investment platforms in the world. Yet our mission, and actually our vision, is not to do this or to act on this by lowering our quality and hoping to increase our volumes. I think Angels Den Funding, what actually does, is trying to find the highest quality opportunities. And this is mainly focused on having partnerships with all the big and all the important accelerators and incubators. Mm-hmm. And in parallel, after doing this, also we have our own pipeline, let's call it, of other opportunities, investment opportunities. We pre-vet them, we screen them, and then we basically finally introduce them to our, I think, more than 20,000 database of investors, angel investors, business angels, as we call them. Mm-hmm. So this is what we want to achieve, yet in order to achieve it, as I said earlier, we are focusing much more on the quality of the opportunity and not necessarily on the volume of opportunities.
Understood. So is it because in that way you could actually have, by focusing on quality as opposed to volume or quantity, you could actually have more of an impact that way?
Exactly. And this is also something that keeps us, to be honest and transparent, keeps us far away from the competition. Literally looking at the last 6 to 9 months of activity, we have accepted less than 0.02% of the startups that have applied. And this is not necessarily because we are extremely picky, but actually our business angels as well, they want startups that will survive and will be in the market for more than 5 years. Which takes us basically to our one of, let's call it our USP, which is more than 90%. Looking at our last internal audit, is 93% of the startups are in the market for more than 5 years.
Yes, got it. And so I'm wrapping my head around the numbers so that I can get a sense of this. 0.02%. So we're talking about, what is that, 1 in 2,000, 1 in 1,000?
0.02, not percent, 0.02. So probably mm-hmm. 2 out of 100 startups.
2 out of 100, yeah,
got it. 2 out of 100 actually end up being in the platform.
Got it. And so that's very, very selective. If you interview and you go through the process with 100 startups, 2 of them, you end up working with you.
Luckily, the digital transformation helps any industry, and especially ours. So building a platform, building behind the platform a very powerful tool with machine learning models, we ended up probably interviewing less than 20% of them. So Yes, initially, all the 100 were vetted and checked one by one by our founder relations team, but now we finally managed to do the transformation as we were planning, and we are interacting with the best of all those startups.
I understand. That's so, it's inspiring, it's empowering, and it also, I appreciate you sharing it because it begins to answer one of the questions that I had for you, which is that at Angel's Den, more than 90% of your funded deals since 2012 are still in business and still growing. So that's almost unheard of, although, you know, given what you're, the way that you're doing it, that it is absolutely inspiring. And so to kind of build on that a little bit more, what would you say would be some of the keys to that amazing success rate?
First, I think we've gathered, depending on the industry, from 40 to 50 factors to even 140 factors, depending on the industry. So our experience, Angel's Den Funding was initially launched in 2007. Then we pivoted in 2013 towards a lead investor model. So one of the things that we're doing, we're always getting a lead investor or a mentor in that particular funding round. The business angel, he needs to also invest in that funding round and to work on the due diligence package as well. And this for sure brings a lot of value because a lead investor having experience in that industry out of the 20,000 ones, it's going to make that company to have a higher probability to succeed. On top of this, we obviously have factors. So going beyond the technical side and the machine learning side, we have factors that we can connect or identify if the friends, fools, and family around did work very well or not, or if the lead investor is in any way connected up before with the startup, or will actually be the voice of our investors. So we've discovered a lot of things. So if the family is not investing in the first round, then coming to a platform with business angels doesn't add up a lot of trust, if not even the family does not invest in you. So it's extremely important to discover factors that are soft skills, combining them with all the technology and everything we can do as an analysis on the crunching data and crunching pitch decks, business plans, and the other ones.
Yeah, absolutely. And you're speaking my language now. Not that you haven't been, but certainly in terms of soft skills, in talking with other technical leaders and investors and just people in that space, that yes, the technology is important. It is the tech industry after all. But at the end of the day, it does come down to those soft skills, those people skills that make a difference. So it sounds like when you're playing the investment game, when you're on that journey toward, okay, we're helping these businesses grow. It's not just about the funky machine learning stuff, which is awesome, and we can geek out about that. But it's about those relationships and about really making sure that they have that support along the way. Is that what you found?
Definitely. Actually, I wanted to mention something in this direction, which is we obviously looked at some failures. We probably have less than 6 or 8 failures in 5-7 years, looking at the past 5 years' results. And every single time we've noticed a growing incompatibility between the mentor and the founder team. And this is mainly one of the reasons that the startups fail. At least we obviously having a 90 plus percent survival rate is amazing, but we also want to learn where is there any catch in the other ones. And yes, to be honest, is about soft skills in the majority of these cases of failure. The founders are too in love with their baby instead of considering the Git company, they don't want to go from the setup towards the growth period or towards the scaling up, and they are actually not capable of leading the company in the other steps of the startup. So soft skills for sure are a big aspect of growing up beyond the first 2 years.
Absolutely. And I also appreciate the learning from the failures as well. What happened there? What went wrong there? What can we learn from it? And you mentioned the founders being too in love with their babies. Can you talk a little bit more about that? Like what the, how that kind of shows up? What does that look like when a founder is too close to what she or he has built?
I think one of the aspects here when we look at founders is that they should be able, this is one of the questions that sometimes I'm asking also myself when looking at the startup, is he willing to step down if he cannot take the company to the next step? Yeah. And this is a very good question. Is he willing to let the company grow, or is he actually going to put the ego in front of it and he still wants to be the CEO and that's it, no matter if the company is going to fail? And you catch them based on their reaction, because it's a very important funding around this, exactly this step. Because if 84 or 86% die in the first 2 years, they literally die probably on three aspects. It's either timing, it's either lack of mentorship, or it's lack of capital. And these three are kind of connected a lot between themselves. And if the founders don't have the right timing and the right mentorship, if they don't react well to feedback and they still pursue their road, even if it's obvious they shouldn't do it, then you will probably end up with a failure.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And ego does get in the way sometimes. I mean, we have an ego, we can't deny that, but it's sort of, it's having that, almost that self, that introspection, looking within yourself to say, you know what, I'm not the one to take this company to the next level. And it sounds like it's those founders who end up, their companies are the ones who end up thriving because they're able to step away and say, you know what, I'm not going to be the leader here. I don't want to be the leader here, and somebody else can do it, and I could still play a role. And that's how you actually get it to the next level beyond the first couple of years.
I'm not trying to imply that founders of initial idea and the ability to execute the MVP are not capable. So I'm definitely not trying to push this message out there. However, it's important to know your weaknesses. It's important to know what are your strengths, to go on them, to follow up on them. And as you said, if you feel that you are much more impactful in a, I don't know, product management position in your company, and if you still own the majority, do it, follow up on that dream and bring a CFO, bring a CMO, bring a growth VP or whatever it's needed to let it grow to the next stages instead of trying to keep it under your wings.
Sure. Yeah. So recognizing your strengths, recognizing your weaknesses, what is my zone of excellence and what really inspires me to do? And hey, maybe it is being CEO, but if it's not, playing another role. And bringing on a team and doing it together. So yeah, I hear you. I hear you loud and clear on that piece of it. You had mentioned one of the things that may cause a company to fail and to not grow beyond the 2 years is timing. So is there a little bit of luck involved in that, like market timing, or is it the right time for this product or this service? Is that what you mean by that?
Definitely. I think it's actually, there's a TED Talk saying that more than 40% of the company's success is based on the timing. I don't have the number, so we don't have yet a model to do the analysis of the exact timing. However, I'm pretty sure I'm not wrong, but if I remember correctly, Nokia launched 4G phones 8 years before the 4G network to even appear. And they had a division that built 20 phones or something, and they had to kill it. And that's it.
Yeah.
So, because that's everything they could do with phones 8 years ahead of 4G network. So this is a very good example of timing. It's you're totally right. I'm not calling it luck, but you should be on an increasing trend of adoption. So the idea should be in the early adoption stage, and the market should be prepared for it.
Yes.
This entire fintech revolution, if it had started 12 years ago, it would have been impossible to do it. If it starts now and everyone is prepared to adopt new technology, everyone is comfortable to have all their cards on their smartphones, that's a good thing. And they're okay to have the money in fintech companies instead of having them in a traditional bank, one of the examples, because we see a lot of them growing up now.
Mm-hmm. So it almost sounds like it's about that that timing is about that careful planning. And in the very early stages of what is our product or service going to be, what are we going to be putting out there, that there is a, that there's a match, that there's some synergy, that people need this, and that you're not, and that there's some indication that it is the right time. And then if it's, maybe it's not the right time, maybe it's not the right time to launch that and you do something else. So it doesn't have to just be luck, that the planning can absolutely play a role here as well.
It's a combination. I'm not a big fan of saying it's just luck, but it's definitely a combination that you actually get it in the right time. And the second one is probably the lean approach. And instead of calling it timing, it might be actually pivoting until the company makes sense and the product makes sense to the user. I'm pretty sure. So there's no example now in my mind, but there are countless startups that they began at something else and they pivoted in their first years, until the product makes sense. And I think one of the very good examples is actually UiPath, a unicorn that's doing RPA, robotic process automation. And they've started around 2006, 2007, and it took them 7 to 8 years to actually have a real product. And now they are, I don't know, valued at 4 billion, if I remember correctly, 3.7 or 4 billion.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, really, really insightful. That's a great example. And so the next thing that I want to talk about, Adrian, because I know that you're someone who is certainly familiar with the European tech startup scene, but also the startup scene globally as well, is essentially, I wonder if you can, because most of my audience is in the US, I know I have some folks over across the pond as well, but predominantly in the US, I wonder if you can give us a peek into the European startup scene. So for those of us who may only be familiar with what's going on in the US, what can we learn from folks that are doing things in other parts of the world?
Let me think. That's a pretty good question, looking at Europe, because you cannot look at Europe as a unity in terms of startups. There are big cities that are driving the tech revolution, we could call it, or the tech startup scene. And London is by far the largest. And if I remember correctly, London has probably, London, the UK has probably 2,500 startups on a daily basis launched. So on a daily, which is a pretty good number, out of which 20% of them are, an estimated 20% of them are tech. So in the evolved, in the better evolved markets, around 20% of all the companies are tech startups. Mm-hmm. In East Europe, as an example, which is two of the examples could be Poland or Romania, the percentage of tech startups is lower. However, because they're starting in a market that's not exposed so easily to global problems, the companies are much more reliable because they're built in a way that they have to become profitable much faster. So I think the main difference is the fact that we don't have the education, at least in the Eastern Europe. So if I'm looking at the Eastern Europe, we don't have the education of burning money for growth because we don't have access to capital in the same way as the US or London has it. If I'm looking on the Western side of Europe, which is London, and we can include probably, if you want to, we can include even Berlin in this side. The access to capital is better. So I think we are a bit delayed in terms of adopting this growth mindset of burning money until it has a huge impact. And we are trying to reach break even faster. So you could see companies that have a way lower valuation than the US, mm-hmm. and they actually make money and they're profitable with the same idea.
That is so interesting. You are blowing my mind a little bit, Adrian. It's hard to even wrap my head around it, because there are cultural factors here, there are historic factors, and then there's just it's based on the experience of living in Poland, in Romania, in Eastern Europe versus London or versus the US, that that's going to drive a lot of the way that the startup scene how it operates. Can you talk a little bit more about, I think you said it particularly in Eastern Europe, that they're not as, just for historic factors, cultural factors, not as familiar with the idea of earning money for growth. Can you talk a little bit more about that so I can wrap my head around it a little more?
Okay, maybe I'll try to reiterate from a different perspective. It's not necessarily they wouldn't burn money for growth. It's the fact that if the Eastern European startups don't have huge access to capital. So I think one of the reasons is the fact that the Eastern European ones don't have access to large capital amounts extremely easy. And this is where, because you cannot burn money for growth, you need to start making some money because otherwise your company would die very fast. So it might be cultural, but it's also a matter of access to capital. That's why a lot of, and this is something that we've noticed and it's extremely obvious, there's a huge tech talent pool in East Europe. And in order to have a startup that's actually going to have a global impact, all of them have to move either to London or to Berlin or maybe to the US to actually have the impact and access to the capital. So it's harder to build a huge startup in an Eastern European country without access to capital. So it might be culture as well, because people are looking at businesses as the definition of business as one that makes money, not having 6 years, 8 years of growth until it actually becomes a global impactful startup. But there's also a lack of capital aspect that we need to keep in mind.
Hi, everyone. We'll get back to the interview in a jiffy. But first, are you a tech manager? In other words, do you lead teams of geeks through long-term complex projects? Do you feel like you're wasting precious time going to useless meetings, dealing with administrative nonsense, and working late nights? Are you working 50 plus hours a week, but don't have the salary to show for it? It doesn't need to be that way. You can build thriving, high-performing teams who produce a measurable positive impact while earning the premium salary you deserve. Oh, and you don't have to work your butt off to get there. If this sounds like the kind of success you're striving for, then go to genbunk.com/webinar to reserve a spot in my free masterclass. I share the 4 shifts that my tech manager clients made to achieve badass career transformation. That's genbunk.com/webinar. Without further ado, please enjoy the rest of the interview.
So sometimes, like in the US, we call it bootstrapped. We picked ourselves up by our bootstraps and we funded it ourselves. Or, you know, sometimes the family helps out a little bit, or you just save the money. And when you don't have access to that capital, when you don't have access to angel investors, what other option is there? Or at least if there's not a lot of it, what other option is there except to figure it out, to get resourceful and to find the money and to save the money on your own? And sometimes when I read about US startups, because there is absolutely access to capital, there is insane access to capital, I almost wonder if it's like some companies are getting into bad habits because they're getting spoiled by having access to so much capital and have not learned how to build that muscle of this is how you grow and this is how you do it without constantly being having that on the side, like, oh, I can always just get more money. You know, it's always there. What if you had to do it yourself? That it would look very different. So it sounds like that's a piece of what you're seeing happen in certain parts of Europe.
Yes, definitely. And there's actually one saying that we have internally. If a company didn't go through a crisis, it's not yet a reliable company. So, as you said, if you're spoiled because of access of capital, that's nice, but you need to pass over a global crisis. That's the moment when you know your company is going to survive no matter what, because it puts you in a way different perspective. It's not the same. Yeah. If you don't have access to capital, a crisis hits you, then you actually need to find solutions.
Yeah. Yeah, that's what builds the muscle. We go through the crisis and we survive the crisis, and that we're winning not because we always win, right? But because we failed many times, but yet we're still fighting.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And I think another, but I do expect it to be global. Even in my case, in angels and funding, we are seeing in a bad month meaning to us probably December, because no one is preparing for a funding round after mid-December or in the first 10 days of January, we have probably 500 startups applying. In a good month, we have up to 2,000 startups a month. Mm-hmm. we are seeing a very huge percentage of male founders. This is something we are trying to work on the diversity. We're trying to understand how we can build the female founders club or to help out more in this direction. And we are also looking on the female investors side as well in order to try to do it better in this direction. We are literally doing our best in this, but as you probably know, diversity is not a problem only in angels and funding or only with companies that are applying to angels and funding. This is at least Europe level and might be the US level as well.
Yeah, and I think that this is a challenge. I think it's a global challenge, and I think it's something that we can figure out together. Especially, yes, getting more female founders, but I absolutely agree with you, getting more female investors as well, because it's just going to, because like attracts like, you know, that this is, you know, a strong woman attracts a strong woman, where it's like, hey, we can do this together. And so that is definitely a step in the right direction that I'm seeing, and it seems very promising. And I'm wondering, you know, on your end, Adrian, it's great that you are taking steps to move in that direction toward a more diverse, to more diversity in founders, more diversity in investors. So is there anything that you've been doing in that regard toward increasing that diversity that you see as promising, you know, steps or actions that you're taking that you can share with us that perhaps can move us in the right direction there?
One of the main activities that we're doing here is a lot of education, because the moment you are focusing on quality, you also have to focus on education. Angel investors need to understand how to do their due diligence. They need to learn more, and we need to learn with them. So we are definitely moving in this education side, and we are trying to involve and get as many. We actually are trying to build a female investors club. We have a London Angels club with extremely experienced ones. We have a fintech club. We have an insurtech club. So we have specifics to tech, but we also want to build one that could help future female founders as well. Mm-hmm. While initially we were against the idea, it seems that this is the only way we can increase the numbers a bit more accelerated. Otherwise, if we will try, we will just use it as a statement to make it sound nice. It's harder to see the numbers growing. So literally, it's education plus trying to build a club that will bring more female founders as well, and to bring more courage. And we also have a lot of talks in incubators and accelerators. And every time we map or we identify female founders with a good idea, we are trying to push as much as possible as we can from our side as well.
Yeah, to support them and let them know that it is a good idea, because doubt can absolutely get in the way. Like, is this going to work? I'm not really sure. And you don't see other people like you succeeding, then that can really take over. But to have people like you, and for the people who you work with who say, no, this is a wonderful idea, and I think we can help you. Like, even just that small gesture can make all of the difference, especially for someone who might be in the very early stages of building a startup, or even just has an idea it's a time that doubt can take over, and anything we could do to support that, that's wonderful.
You need this relentless courage and ambition to do it. And I think the study appeared, I hope it's not from LinkedIn, or it might be from LinkedIn. In average, women apply only when 9 out of 10 skills are checked on their CV, but yeah, men apply on 4 to 5 out of 10. So we that. Basically, in order to actually push this courage and relentless ambition is hard, because it's not a natural behavior. We are actually more risk friendly, and we need to help out as much as possible, and we need to lend a hand and to make sure we are doing the best efforts on our side.
Yeah. One of my business coaches once told me that there's two things that you need to build a business, and that's grit and tenacity. And that's basically what you're saying, is you need that ambition, and you need to be able to have that, to build that grit to tolerate the risk, because building any business, there is going to be risk involved. And so certainly an education helps there, but I'll just sort of tapping into it. You know, I believe that we all have that, right? We all have that ability to tap into that ambition, to tap into that grit and tenacity. But just for certain people, it's harder to do. It's not as natural to do. But it's really about learning those skills and building, you know, sharpening that sword, so to speak. So absolutely, I love what you're doing there. I'm looking forward to hearing about the success continued successes that you're having, both in terms of helping startups in general, but also in terms of increasing the diversity as well. It's awesome what you're doing.
Thank you.
Yeah, awesome. All right, Adrian. So at this point, what I'm going to do is I'm going to move to the last question. And this is the question that I ask all of my podcast guests. And that is, what is the biggest people-related challenge in your job?
After taking over angels and funding, I think I had to cope and to face a cultural environment with six or seven nationalities and six or seven cultures, different cultures. I think the main challenge is that, from my perspective, management should not exist. I'm going to say it extremely straight, because leadership should give you the direction, and the people you choose to be beside you, they should be able to follow up on that direction or to move or to adapt continuously with the company and its vision. So the biggest challenge is to find autonomy in the team members, to find people that want to have self-evolution, ambition, and the same thing that we were discussing earlier about, mm-hmm. a bit of relentless moving forward, even if there's feedback or not. So the biggest challenge is probably access to talent pool, but for this one, luckily, there's no geography anymore, so you don't have any limits and you can find people anywhere. But to have ambition, so I think this is the first one, to find people with ambition.
Sure.
Second, to find people that are not looking at the 8 to 5 or 9 to 5, that are looking to self-develop themselves, to prepare themselves for the future. And the third one is to understand the cultures. So in order to connect the cultures and to make them compatible, looking at American way of saying things, looking at the British politeness way of saying things, mm-hmm. looking at Eastern European cultures where people are usually taking it much more personal when you have a statement, you need to be careful. So I think it's the intercultural dimension that brings the biggest, the largest challenge that I'm coping every day with it.
Got it. And I have a couple of follow-up questions there, because it's all great stuff and it really resonates with me. So the first thing was management shouldn't exist. And then you mentioned about leadership giving direction. So it sounds like you're making the distinction there, that there's a difference between management and leadership. We don't need management, but we do need leaders to set that direction.
Yes, definitely. We need meaning. We need a reason to come to work. We need a reason to believe the people around us in the same thing. And I don't think this is done by management. It will never be done by management. Management, I do understand it in a factory. I do understand it in a line factory, industrial production, or things like these. But the moment you are in a services industry, mm-hmm. it's much more about the meaning of what you're doing and the fact that you want to make it better day over day.
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely. So we need those vision setters, those communicators of the mission and the vision and the values, and this is why we're doing it. And then we need people with relentless ambition without feedback. And that's right, scary for a lot of people, right? That's why everybody doesn't build a business, right? And can't do it successfully, because you gotta be able to do it without constant feedback. And some people, that's what they need. They need every single day, they need to know, am I doing this right? Am I doing this right? I hear you loud and clear on that. And I make the distinction between management and leadership a lot, that you don't need to have a leadership job title. You know, you don't need to have vice president in front of your name or chief something officer, you know, before your name in order to be a leader. Anybody can stand up and lead. And as you say, take that, you know, that relentless action, be relentlessly ambitious. That's really what it takes. I could not agree with you more. And you would also, yeah, go ahead. I was going to ask about cultures.
Yeah, I think you just spotted a very important one. It's not even a matter of job titles. The relationship between team members is building by itself. Indeed, you need to have some people liaisons. So you need to have people that are capable of gathering people around them. And this is what good leaders are doing. And second, even if we want it or not, you also have to be able to sell a bit the vision. It's not just saying it, it's actually selling it to your team sometimes, because they need to believe in it, in that vision, and they need to follow you on that vision.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
So, yeah, and culturally, as you said, it's a huge challenge to make sure that the way you're handling and saying the messages, the way you're trying to get the people around, it works for German people, it works for British people, it works for Polish people, it works for American people. Because they're not reacting on the same messages. They're not reacting on the same behavior. So sometimes you need to actually spend much more time on the leadership and on the vision side than actually managing the business itself to make sure everything goes in the right direction.
Yeah, absolutely. And regarding the understanding the cultural differences, can you share with us any advice? So for those of us who may not be doing this every day. So in other words, interacting with folks from Germany or Poland, are there particular, let's just say mistakes. Are there mistakes that folks from the US make? You know, inadvertently, we don't mean to, but mistakes that folks from the US that can make, what mistakes do we make that might inadvertently be thought of as rude or just not okay in other European cultures?
Unfortunately or fortunately, I think my way of saying things or pushing messages is much more American way. And sometimes this, as you say, it hurts specific perceptions. So one of the mistakes, I think there's sometimes the transparency or the feedback should never be negative. It sounds weird, but you should focus much more on strength and how to increase it and what you have to work on instead of saying what did not work. Yeah. Second, in Eastern European countries, there's a higher exposure to negotiation. However, they take it very personally. So you always need to be very careful when saying something, because everything you're saying, it's about them as person, not about their business or professional aspect of their life. Mm-hmm. So they literally interiorize it as being about themselves and what they have achieved in their life. With the German war, the Polish people, as an example, there's no negotiation. You just approve something, accept something, and everything moves in that direction. So comparing British to American, I think in Britain there's a hidden politeness that you should always be careful at, because it's not the words, it's actually the gestures that you will understand. If you're doing the right thing, or if you're saying something that bothers or not.
Oh, interesting. That in for the British have a hidden politeness, or the U.S.
The British. The British. From my perspective, the American is full transparency. So at least this is how I see it. Maybe I have I also have a different a skewed perspective, but it's a very, very large amount of transparency, and no one takes it personal, and they understand. Look. This is wrong. We need to do it now. We need to solve it. And this is something you wouldn't say in a full of British environment.
That goes back to it's that the feedback is positive. The feedback it's feed forward almost. This is what I want to see you do this more in the future. That's what's going to help us get there, as opposed to you did this wrong. Which almost feels like, okay, what do you want me to do? You know? And so that's something that I've noticed in my coaching too, that I've incorporated the phrase, this is great. What I want to see you do more of is this, because that's much more help. That's the feedback I would rather receive than, Jen, you did it wrong. Doesn't feel good to do that. And it's also not actionable either. And so having that actionable feedback is what's...
Definitely. There's no such thing as feedback without discussing about the future or discussing about the course of the next actions. However, it depends a lot on the way you're putting it, on the way you're expressing it. Mm-hmm. So, and also I met founders, and I met also executives in corporate environments that not necessarily didn't push on this feed forward, but they were trying to be a bit more, no, a bit less time consuming to say it faster, much more direct, which I actually, as an example, as a personality, I accepted because I want to know what I have to work on. And I want to know also, basically, when I'm building the scenarios of working on something, I want to know if they're compatible with their vision. And you can solve this one in a 3 minutes call, or you can go through a 1 hour discussion about your future development. It depends a lot on how you want to handle it and how fast you want to solve problems. And also depends on the culture if they accept it in a 3 minutes call or it needs a 1 hour feedback.
Mm-hmm. That's a wonderful point. And also, I'm also curious about the hidden politeness of the British. So are there certain hand gestures that is it that the U.S. engage in certain hand gestures that the British might find impolite? Or is it that maybe it's more when you're talking with someone from the U.K. or Britain, that it's more about not just hearing the words, but also the nonverbal piece of it as well is so important?
It's the second one. You need to be extremely careful on the way they're expressing, on the way they're reacting on your speech. So I think it's much more about how they react and you need to be much more careful and not necessarily about what you're doing with your hands personally. It's more about how they react to what you're saying.
Yeah, I can see that. And you know what? There are certainly cultural differences because somebody who grew up in Poland or in Germany or in the UK versus the US is just going to have different experiences and a different history. But the more that I hear about, you know, folks like yourself who are interacting with folks from all around the world, we really are all the same. You know what I mean? Like, there may be tendencies, but look, I want people to look at my expression as well and not just listen to the words, but feel what it is that I'm saying. Because you could say the same words, but, you know, there can be a different feeling behind it. So
exactly.
Something to learn from all the different cultures.
No, it's a lot of experience you need to gather at a certain point.
Yeah, absolutely. It's been so wonderful speaking with you today, Adrian. Is there anything else? Is there anything else on your mind or anything else that you want to share in terms of your experiences helping to, you know, to build these wonderful companies in Europe and really just moving the tech community forward? Anything else that you'd like to share so that we can take it with us and learn from it?
I think if I were to put it in two sentences, first, expose yourself to all the possible industries and to all the possible experiences and on any level. You can learn from a junior, you can learn from an executive level. Mentorship is not about only having extremely old and experienced people around you or in the board. So this is the first one. Choosing mentors is not about choosing the old executives and that's it. Second message that I would like to send is always look from the other perspective on the other side of the table. One of the things that I've been extremely lucky, as you said earlier, being lucky is that I've launched startups in services, startups in technology, and I'm also helping startups to get funding. This probably did give me a huge perspective in terms of how things are moving in this ecosystem. If you only build startups, it's harder to see the investment side. If you all your life you only did investment, it might be harder for you to understand how a startup gets built. Mm-hmm. So expose yourself on every side of the table as much as possible and choose mentors that you can learn at any level from any industry at any moment.
Yes, absolutely. Thank you for that. Very inspiring, very action-oriented. I love it. And if anybody wants to learn more about you or more about Angels Den Funding, where's the best place to go?
Definitely Angels Den Funding blog section. We have a lot of articles that will help learning about how to build a startup, how to do pitch decks, etc. And obviously website at any moment. I can be contacted through Angels Den or at adrian@angelsden.com.
Excellent. Very good. Thank you, Adrian. It's been a pleasure speaking with you today.
Same to me, and thank you for the invitation.
Yes, absolutely.